Hello and welcome to the Joyful Doctor podcast. My name is Dr. Caroline Walker, and in today's episode you'll be hearing from another inspiring healthcare professional all about managing the highs and lows of life as a caring person. Keep listening to find out how you can bring more joy into your life. To the latest episode of the Joyful Doctor podcast. I'm delighted to have with me today Nick Malkinson. Welcome, Nick.
Hello, Caroline. Pleasure to be here.
So good to have you with us. Nick, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm an integrative psychotherapist. I spend a lot of my time with NHS practitioner health, and I also have my own private practice under Udomedics Wellbeing for Doctors. So I spend a lot of time working with doctors.
Wonderful. So you are a therapist by background. I think you have you have a degree in positive psychology or something like that, right?
Yeah, so I have actually have a first degree in artificial intelligence and cognitive science from a very long time ago. What indeed. Yeah, I studied artificial intelligence in a time when people were depressed about artificial intelligence. Well, it's never going to happen. We're not going to make it. Things have changed. So I had a first career in computing and IT. And then got interested in psychology starting about 14 years ago. So I did a conversion psychology degree, I did a master's in positive psychology, and then more recently I did a master's in integrative counselling therapy and coaching.
And I really wanted to get you on the podcast, and I've been wanting to get you on for a while because I know you've been doing some incredibly interesting work around success and failure and how that can impact on doctors and their well-being. So we will dive into that in a minute, but let me start by asking you what I ask all my podcast guests. What does it mean to you to be joyful?
Sure. Very nice question. Just before that, just to say, I've been a therapist for 6 years now, and I think I've probably done at least 4,000 clinical hours, and at least about 95% of that is with doctors. So I've spotted a few patterns, and which we'll talk about that later on. But for me, being joyful, I guess since I spend a lot of time doing this, is it's very joyful to make a difference. Often I will do about 12 sessions with people, and at the beginning, one's really not quite sure how this is going to work out. As one gets to know a client and what's going on for them. But it's really a pleasure to see people shift and move and get to the place they want to get to. I think that's one of the greatest pleasures.
That's what really motivates me as well, that feeling one-to-one when you, as you say, you get to know someone, and although you know you've got the experience and you've helped people before, there is always that little unknown element, isn't there, when you start working with somebody for the first time and they don't know you either, and then you settle into it and they start to get better, and it's nothing like it, no greater feeling in the world. So I really relate to that one. And we also like to talk on this podcast about times when we weren't so joyful, just to kind of normalize that for people, that we all have tough times. So can you tell us about a time when you perhaps weren't feeling so joyful?
Yes. Well, I could give you my life history, but I'm sure that would take up most of the podcast. But certainly as a teenager, there were some times when I wasn't quite so joyful. And as in my early 20s, there were also some times when I wasn't so joyful. But those were great learning opportunities. And hopefully, I've had some lifelong learning. And hopefully I bring some of that lifelong learning into my sessions with my clients. But I guess where I struggle currently is, when I'm not making a difference, when I'm feeling stuck, when I may have to face a client may not be happy. It happens sometimes, and it's how do I cope with that? Which I think we're going to talk more about later on. But facing into what I call moments of failure, and being with that, but without becoming too unjoyful about it.
Yeah, let's dive straight in, because that's what I want to talk to you about. Because you have picked up, as you say, these patterns from working with thousands of doctors, well, hundreds of doctors over thousands of hours. You've picked up on these patterns, haven't you? And I think they're very, very astute, and I certainly recognise them in myself. Where it's all about success and failure, and how we set ourselves up almost to then, when we fail, it becomes almost catastrophic. So tell us a bit about this. Like, where did this? How did you spot this pattern? Like, what did you notice?
Sure. So, well, as always, one looks inside oneself. One's always most motivated to solve one's own problem. So it's definitely part of my own pattern, but also as working with many doctors. And also some of my colleagues at Practitioner Health are CBT therapists in a modality called REBT, Rational Emotive Behaviour Therapy. It's one of the first schools of CBT. And I did some training in New York at the Albert Ellis Institute in sort of 2021, 2022. And there's some very powerful insights there. But the main pattern I really saw is that many doctors have a history of success. And that could be a sort of stereotypical history of success, doing well at primary school, secondary school, medical school, perhaps under medical training, maybe for some periods of their career. But at some point, they seem to get into environments where that success is more difficult. And there are sort of two forms. There's a kind of a chronic version where there's a chronic threat that things may not work out. And that might be, you know, training to be a GP, things have gone well all the way until one's dropped into the consulting room. And perhaps one's sense of self revolves around, you know, keeping other people happy, knowing what you need to know, getting things right. And suddenly one's in a context where that validation isn't going to happen. So what I noticed about these histories of success is they seem to get bound up with people's sense of self.
I can really relate to this, right? I wanted to be a doctor from a young age. I did well at school. I went on the conveyor belt, I call it, you know, the university and out the other end, and had until that point not had many massive hiccups, a couple along the way. But then hitting the woods and becoming a doctor, suddenly it was a whole different ballgame. The rules had changed, the environment was different, and I couldn't succeed as much as I had been used to. So, yeah, mm-hmm. very challenging. Mm-hmm. And I see it a lot in doctors at the moment, particularly GPs. Actually, it's interesting you use analogy of someone being dropped into a consulting room. But we do see that with GPs, you know, suddenly having 40 patients to see, and just you cannot maintain that level of success that you have been used to. Yeah.
Yes. It's almost like, you know, as we grow up, we develop forms of performance that kind of work. They kind of meet our needs, meet other people's needs, and they kind of get reinforced. And then somehow our mind sort of creates a generalization, which is I'm the person who keeps other people happy. I'm the person who does well in exams. I'm the person who cares.
And helps all my patients.
And helps all my patients.
Keep up with the work and get home on time at night. And then that all goes to pot.
And somehow there's a sort of an abstraction process that the mind has stripped away, that I did well in particular environments that were supportive of doing well. And instead, it makes a generalization, which is, I'm now this person, and therefore I should be able to pull this off in any possible environment. So the mind sort of stripped out the detail.
Yeah, so I'm guessing you then blame yourself, right? If I can't keep up, it's because I'm failing. It's not because there's too much to do. It's because I can't do it. I'm not fast enough or efficient enough or successful enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I've failed to sort of be myself.
Yeah.
Or either there's a threat that I'm going to fail to be myself, which is creates a kind of chronic anxiety.
Yes, we see that a lot in doctors. Yeah.
Or there's an acute where there is actually a failure.
Yeah, like they make a mistake, or they get depressed, or burnt out, and have to go off work sick, or can't keep up,
Yeah. In which case, it may be more depression, falling out of the workplace, burnout.
Yeah.
And then maybe a secondary layer that, you know, if I'm someone who's in A&E or a speciality like that, we're the last people standing, and suddenly I'm not even standing anymore. And then there's like a double whammy. I may have failed my patients, I've failed my team, and now I've just failed to be myself. So it can quite cascade.
Yeah, well, I remember one of the first times I went off ill before I really had insight into all of this stuff for myself. And I still remember sitting on the sofa, having gone off sick from work that day, thinking, oh my God, who am I? If I'm not a doctor, then I couldn't even put it into words. Like, I didn't even understand how I could exist in the world, or what I would do, or how I would be, or how. And it's suddenly you're flooded with all these awful, catastrophic thoughts of what others are going to think. Or, yeah, I can really relate to both of those, actually, the chronic sort of drip, 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 but also that kind of sudden failure of like, whoa.
And I think these, you know, I guess in CBT, one talks about a belief. Or in REBT, they talk about something like a rigid demand, or some sense that something must be the case.
Mm.
Which sounds like a sort of an idea, but I think what we're talking about here is, you know, really core motivations. So, you know, a sense that I must care for people, but it's not just an idea. It's like wired into the drive system. Mm. And so, which is great. You know, I wake up in the morning, I have a sense I know who I am, and I know what I'm going to go and do, and I'm probably going to go off and do all kinds of productive things and contribute to lots and lots of people, and that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. But that same system can cause these kinds of problems in particular environments. So that's the particular pattern I've seen, and it can become very debilitating. And it's, to be able to solve that is an important thing.
Yes, but it is solvable, isn't it? And we work with doctors, you and I, Nick, every day where this happens. And there is, and it has happened to me personally, and we do heal from it. And I think part of what found fascinating is your process around that and the ideas of what then helps someone to get through either a catastrophic failure or that drip, 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 you know, effect. So what have you found has been helpful?
Sure. So as an integrative psychotherapist, I guess that, you know, I pull on different forms of theory and practice. And so I've sort of cobbled together a sort of working hypothesis and model around this. So I'll be a little bit academic for a minute, if that's all right.
For a moment, Nick. Okay.
All right. Not for long. But just to throw in some of the ingredients.
we shall all coo and ah and be impressed. And then we'll want a translation.
All right. Well, hopefully, well, it's interesting. In my sort of kind of counselling training, I was told that I like models too much and I should have really dumbed my language down. But instead, I found an audience that likes models.
Brilliant.
So that's kind of my way around of doing that. So yes, throw in some ingredients. So someone called Carol Dweck, who's a professor at Stanford, and she's very famous for growth and fixed mindset. But many psychology theories are very specific because we want to operationalize them, so we need to, you know, control our variables. But she was brave. In 2017, she wrote a paper, A Unified Theory of Personality, Motivation, and Development. So she tried to do a big picture bit of thinking. Mm-hmm. And she kind of put together kind of what we've been talking about, that as we develop, we find various forms of performance that meet our needs, that those then get associated with our identity. And then there's a drive for some sort of self-congruence. Once our sense of self has been developed through this kind of generalization process, we want to stay congruent with our idea of ourselves. So that's...
Yeah. Medical students, that's it, isn't it? You're conditioned to do lots and lots of things that give you that positive feedback, that reinforce that message that you are a good doctor or a good person or a caring person. And that then kind of gets continually reinforced by doing the job.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's like positive reinforcers and negative reinforcers. There are lots of negative reinforcers in medicine, lots of possible threats.
Yeah, things that could go wrong that you try to avoid. And if I stay late, if I do this, then I'll avoid making that mistake or missing that, you know, making that error or missing that important thing.
Yeah, and I think part of working with people for me is being really compassionate to the formation of their drives. And as you said, have they been reinforced both positively and negatively? And talking about it, because often there's a lot to celebrate there. So that's bit of theory number one. Bit of theory number two I borrow from Carl Rogers, who's a founder of sort of counselling. And he had a model of the ideal self and the actual self. So I tweaked those a little bit. So I'm interested in what I call the ideal lived self. So often, you know, we have a self that is our sort of success self, and we enjoy doing it, and we've had a lot of experience of it, and it's the kind of person we like to be. And he compares that with the actual self, and he says when there's a lack of congruence between the ideal self and the actual self, then the sort of psychological tension. So I'm interested in the actual self, but I'm actually even more interested in what I call the feared self. And the feared self is kind of who we think we'll be if we can't keep up with the standards of the ideal self. And then often people, you know, they sort of seesaw between these two big...
Between the ideal self and the feared self?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm either going to be the best doctor in the world or I'm going to be absolutely the worst and unable to do anything. Yeah. There's no gray.
Yeah. And I kind of call that the washing machine. It's not very sophisticated, but it's like there's a continual drive to try and get towards the ideal self, but there may be a continuing threat. Let's say we're in the, you know, in the GP situation or some other situation. And so the feared self keeps on rearing itself. Then let's work harder to try and get back the ideal lived self. And also there's this strong drive. There's this strong drive that perhaps, you know, I must get things right. I mustn't make a mistake.
Yeah. I must put my patients first. I must finish all the jobs on my list.
But that conditioning can go back right to the beginning of, you know, keeping other people happy, you know, being good. It can go back a long, long way. Or it can be being picked on and wanting to avoid, but I became a nerd and I became a geek and then people liked me because I got those skills, like those academic skills. But don't let me go back to that. So I've got to keep up my getting everything right. Otherwise, I might go back to being bullied or, you know, these very early formative experiences that still drive present day performance. So the next piece, if we take that idea of this really strong motivational drive that I must get things right, I must care for people, again, not just as an idea, but really in the drive system, I then link that into REBT, where Albert Ellis, the founder of that, had a really powerful insight. And his insight was that when people have this really strong form of motivation, that it's so strong that it feels like something must or must not be the case, three things cluster with it if it's under threat. And the three things that cluster are, you know, if I feel I must get everything right, for example, and that's under threat or it actually occurs, then the three things that cluster is self-depreciation, you know, I'm now useless, catastrophizing, which with doctors, all, you know, I'll be in front of the GMC and I'll lose my license and I'll lose my house. And the last sense is it would be unbearable.
Yes. Gosh, you've nailed it there. When I was sitting on that sofa, that's exactly what was going on. It felt absolutely unbearable. You know, I see why doctors can be led to really quite extreme actions in those moments. And, you know, and we do know sadly that some don't survive those moments of so trapped in that horrible, fearful state that they don't see a way out.
Yes. Yeah. And again, that link to that the sense of self. And that sort of, that sort of total sense of failure. So we can be, and clearly, you know, often working with clients and patients, one needs to be hugely compassionate. That, you know, maybe reaching out, there may be huge levels of shame about reaching out.
Yeah. No, I was scared. And I remember I got a phone call from the consultant that day who was so kind and so simply just said, it's going to be okay. You know, it's all right. Just use it burns out. You can have a bit of time off. We'll get you some support. You'll get better. It's going to be okay. And that was life-saving to me in that moment. Because like you said, I was in this place of absolute catastrophic fear and all or nothing thinking I'm going to be, you know, yes. I can't exist almost. Yes. I can't continue to be this version of myself that I thought I was. And yes. Yet actually the reality was much more nuanced and yeah.
So let's think about the way out or the way forwards through this. So for me, it's a number of different pieces to it. But for me, the part of the core of the problem is this rather non-conscious generalization process that is the basis of our sense of self.
Mm.
And as I said earlier, the mind is creating a sense of self by abstracting away from the context.
The idea is if I do something good, like I look after my patient well, I then think I am a good person. So I'm generalizing out to my whole self. I'm a good doctor, I'm a good person. And the brain likes to do that, doesn't it? Likes to generalize. And actually the problem in doing that is that when then something bad goes wrong, we can also generalize that. So it's, you know, I've made a mistake. Oh my God, I'm the worst doctor ever. I'm terrible. So are we trying to kind of steer away from that generalizing? Is that the idea?
Yeah, but often it's not a singular incident that's going to be cause the generalization. It's like, you know, 20 years passing
true.
Exams
yeah.
or lots and lots of feedback, maybe on a daily basis for being a particular yeah. kind of person, having a particular kind of performance that one likes. You know, I grew up playing lots of rugby. You know, I loved getting the ball. It's very simple stuff, but I always kind of got a kick, very willful. Let's nail it.
Yeah.
But, you know, over 10 years, that kind of doing that activity has got wired into my sense of self. I'm someone who doesn't yeah. back down. I'm the person who breaks through.
We get this daily drip from our patients often, don't we? This kind of, thank you so much, Dr. Orr, that's really helped. That kind of you constant little drip, so that when you then get a complaint or you get 360-degree feedback with that one negative comment, suddenly it's blown out of proportion, isn't it? We magnify it.
Yeah, I think if it gets associated with our sense of self, some things don't get associated with our sense of self. So, you know, someone might have a hobby where their identity isn't associated with it. They've started dancing or something and they don't do it very well. Well, no problem. I don't think I'm a dancer. It's not part of who I am. For that failure is not associated with the sense of self. So it's not going to trigger that kind of cascade.
The issue is when we associate it with who we are.
So the first way of begin to come out of it is often I work with my clients to reconstruct those histories, which is quite fun, to build awareness of, you know, what happened. And also, if someone's kind of depressed, it can be quite joyful to go back to the ideal lived self, which they may not have experienced for some time.
Yeah, like reconnect with that person that was, you know, is successful and is able to do, you know, those good things and feel that.
Yes. But then we want to see it was a, you know, it was a synergy between a specific set of environments and talents and efforts. But now we're in a different environment. And also to see this kind of what I call the godlike demand on the self. There's been this rather non-conscious, creeping godlike demand on the self, which, you know, we then talk about how reasonable is that? Or once it's in the light, people very quickly see, well, that's a bit ridiculous.
I think a lot of doctors have it, right? I certainly did. And I do still sometimes that kind of idea that I can be better than or bigger than or somehow. I think when you've had a life where you've managed to achieve or you've had that positive feedback or told you can do things, and it feeds that a little, doesn't it? That idea that you can be godlike, which is hard to admit. But I think most doctors would, on some level, probably recognise a bit of that in themselves.
Yeah, and I really don't mean it in terms of any sense of arrogance. It's that one's, you know, hugely motivated and one has been successful and that motivation has been really, really useful and one has done remarkable things. But I only mean it in that there's been this generalization that somehow the mind then thinks I should be able to pull this off in any environment. And that makes the person very tough on themselves. It has nothing to do with hubris. It's the toughness on the self. Yeah, the godlike demand doesn't mean that someone is arrogant or had a god complex. It's really just a very strong demand on the self to be able to pull off that level of performance in any possible environment.
Something that we might call high expectations. We have high expectations of ourselves.
So we've talked about the Ellis cascade and all those things all clustered together. So we've talked about beginning to try and be aware of the generalization process. And by being aware of it, we begin to kind of, the person can begin to kind of go, oh, you know. And where I kind of want to help people get to is a sense that there have been moments of doing well, but we don't need to generalize that. You know, there'll be particular talents, skills, efforts, and environments which have worked nicely synergistically together. We may meet those again in the future. We may meet those on a daily basis, which is wonderful, and we can enjoy that and contribute through that. But it doesn't mean there may be moments when there isn't a good fit. It may be the environment is overwhelming. It may become chronically overwhelming. But to recognize that's not a failure of self, it may be a failure to live up the standards I want to.
Mm.
And one can acknowledge this is not comfortable and this is not what I want. And it's not about capitulating. But it's be able to accept there may be moments of not doing as well as I want to. And I may need to accept that, regroup, have a go another day when the weather is better. And I talk to my clients about levels of motivation. Because some people say, well, is that sort of capitulating? And it's not. And so I sort of say there's under-motivation, which is kind of capitulating. I'd kind of like something to happen, but I'm not going to put the effort in, so it's not going to happen. There's over-motivation, which is what we've kind of been talking about, that I'm going to make a demand on myself that I must make this happen, even though I can't, and then I'm going to catastrophize, beat myself up, and sort of melt down, which is kind of it's a motivation that's not actually helping me get to the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's kind of an optimal motivation, which has this sort of flexibility to go, I'm going to do what I can, and I'm going to stop when I need to. And I'll have another go in a different way as and when. But it's sort of, so I can sit with a moment of failure against my own standards without the meltdown. And then I can flex and continue as best I can. I feel like I'm talking a lot, Caroline. How are we doing?
It's lovely listening to it. So I'm guessing the brain is going to want to generalize, right? Because that's what the brain does. So we're not going to
absolutely.
We're not going to switch that off. It's just kind of acknowledging, my brain's trying to tell me that this is kind of all or nothing. I'm either brilliant or I'm terrible. And actually, it's a bit more nuanced than that. That I am, there's going to be moments when I'm successful and things go well, and moments when it's less so. And it may not just be about me. It might be about the environment and about pressures. And I think that's such a key message for doctors to hear right now, because I am seeing so many doctors still really beating themselves up and taking responsibility for their situation when actually they have been working in an unsustainable way because of the work demands or the lack of resources or see nothing to do with them. They're incredibly capable, incredibly resilient, very successful, very good at their jobs generally.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But the situation they then find themselves in is untenable. It's unsustainable. And the first thing they're doing is blaming themselves. And actually, I really want to start putting that narrative back into, well, no, actually, I'm good at my job, but there are certain circumstances in which it's not going to be possible to sustain those levels of expectations on myself.
Yes, yes.
And that's not a problem with me or my colleagues. It's a system issue.
Yes, absolutely.
So how do doctors, when they work through this process, where do they get to? What's the kind of, they come from this place of shame and catastrophic thinking and fear and who am I and all that.
Yes.
And they work through this stuff, and where do they end up?
Sure. Where do they end up? Well, multiple things, I guess. There may be some humour that comes in, as opposed to sort of chronic anxiety or oppression. I guess I talked about this idea of optimal motivation. So it's someone who's motivated, who loves what they do, are committed to what they do. And obviously, this is going to depend on each individual and what they want. So I'm just going to give some broad generalizations here for the kinds of things. But they can stop when they need to stop. They can be assertive, perhaps, when they need to be assertive.
Mm-hmm.
They can perhaps take a break when they need to take a break and then kind of go back in. They can take a heavy load, but not the toll, internal toll isn't as heavy as it was.
I love that. They can take a heavy load, but the internal toll is not so heavy. That's kind of what healthcare professionals need, isn't it, in a nutshell? Because the load is always going to be heavy. And I think this is something I come back to time and again as I spend more time working in this field with doctors and thinking about the well-being and my own well-being, is we're never going to get to a point where being a doctor is easy, right? Because we can't escape from the fact that there's uncertainty and risk and pain and human relationships and expectations and all of this stuff, right? And we work in one of the biggest organizations in the world. So there's masses of different stresses and strains, and it's never going to be easy, right? But it's about being able to work within that environment in a way that you say you're optimal motivation. So you're feeling comfortable, you're motivated and happy and in tune with your drive is there, and you're not so enmeshed with it, I guess. That it then, if something goes wrong, it kind of topples you.
Yeah, and it's almost that kind of conflict between one's motivation and the environment. If I say that I must be able to look after everybody, and then clearly I can't.
Yeah.
But instead, the mind's going to, this is Ellis's language, I'm going to disturb, the mind's going to disturb itself about it. So I'm going to beat myself up and I'm going to catastrophize. But sort of taking that bit out, so to be able to be with it and kind of go to recognize this is a difficult environment there, I can do my utmost, but then I can pull back a bit and kind of create a sustainable way of being
It's really interesting because when I think back to COVID and when that first hit and the pandemic and the individual doctors and the teams that kind of flourished more or at least thrived a bit more in COVID rather than drowned or struggled were the ones that kind of accepted the situation is different here. So we need to look at this. I mean, to look at ourselves and our resources and think, what can we do? What's possible and what's feasible and how can we look after ourselves in that? Whereas the doctors or the teams that went, actually, we've got to keep doing what we've been doing. We've got to keep providing the best level of care possible. We've got to keep doing this. And we've now got to deal with this massive, great big, you know, pandemic and all that that brings, really struggled. Because they didn't look at that interaction between the self and the environment and take a rational look at it. It was more kind of, I'm just going to keep going with this. We must be the gold standard caregivers in every way, right? And that's not possible, is it, in every situation?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So something about our conversation is making me slightly uneasy, and I was trying to explain what it is, which is clearly I'm not a doctor, and I don't carry the stresses of being a doctor. Clearly, I carry the stresses of being a therapist, and there's some overlap. But I guess the way I try and work is I try and, you know, I work with the motivation of the client. And no, I would never want to be telling a doctor how to be a doctor or, you know, we've described some possible outcomes, but there's no sense that anybody should, you know, my role is to work with people on their aspirations, on their motivations and help them undo the kinks, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And to be hugely compassionate, you know, these patterns, we can talk about them now, but if you're in it, it's really difficult. It's so difficult to see.
So hard. I mean, it took me months certainly to start to unpick that little bit for myself that first time when I went off and it's still there as you were talking today. So I'm now like 20 years on from medical school, scary, and I still now working for myself doing a job I absolutely love. I'd say I hit the optimal motivation, you know, bit fairly well most days, but I still get drawn into this idea that, oh, but what if I stopped doing this for a bit? Or what if this went wrong? Or what would people think? Or it's still enmeshed in my identity. So there's something about us, I think, isn't there, as healthcare professionals that we are drawn to, or somehow it's stickier for us, this area. It clings to our identity more, I think, than it does perhaps in other areas of work. I don't know. Just that's my observation. Maybe it's just a human thing.
I think the general pattern is a human thing. You know, if you were an amazing footballer and your identity forms around that, and then you're getting older and you can't perform the same standard, you may begin to have some problems. But there's definitely, I think medicine is kind of like a crucible of stressors. They're both the positives, all the encouragement growing up and doing well at school and getting into the system, and then hit with all of these different stresses. It's quite a difficult mix of elements.
So the amazing footballer, because actually, maybe it's to do with that. It's the fact that there's something about how well it's perceived, isn't it, culturally still to be a kind of a higher level achievement. You know, if you say to someone still to this day, if you say to someone, I'm a doctor, or I want to be a doctor when I grow up, people are like, oh, wow, that's amazing. And they'll use words like amazing, right, that they wouldn't necessarily use with other.
Yes.
And so I wonder if there's something, you know, in that, in the cultural mix, in the psychological mix of our brains, that's like, well, those high expectations are just inbuilt because then we do this thing that reinforces it, and then it carries on like a vicious cycle.
Yes, no, absolutely.
Oh, so fascinating. Nick, I could talk to you about this all day. I'm just so grateful to you to be doing this work and to be so astute to picking up on these patterns, because I think these are things that we are still learning how to put words to, you know, in this field, and in helping doctors and in helping ourselves. I think you're absolutely right. It all starts with us, doesn't it? And this is wonderful to see how these theories and this work from all these different people over the years is now kind of being pulled together, and through your work it's being taken forward, and you're helping people with this every day, and I just feel so grateful to you for that. And I guess I don't want to end without asking you, like, if you wanted to pass on like one key message to doctors that are listening to this, if it was your last chance to sort of say something to a doctor might be struggling with this success track, you know, what would you say?
What would I say? It's a really good question. I think often, you know, when we've grappled with a problem space for a while, you know, within ourselves, the mind can sometimes kind of go, well, I've grappled with this for a while and I haven't really found any solutions, so maybe there aren't any solutions. So there's that cliche about, you know, the stuff I know and I know that I know it, the stuff I don't know and I know that I don't know it, and then the stuff I don't know and I don't know that I don't know it. So somehow for me, the hope is always keeping that door open that, you know, maybe there's something I don't know and don't know that I don't know it. And hopefully these kind of distinctions somehow begin to fill some of that space if one's in this kind of trap. So, you know, perhaps it's worth reaching out and there's some hope.
Oh, gosh. Do you know, that makes me, I feel really moved hearing you say that, because in those moments, you can't see past your own nose for the, because you're so in your head and you're so scared. And so much of this, as you say, goes so deep and it's so overwhelming. It's like to know, to have somebody say to you in that moment, there is hope. You might not be able to see clearly right now how you're going to get through this, but you can and you will get through this. And thank you. That's a wonderful message. And are there any particular resources that you could point people towards if they wanted to find out more about this, or maybe get in contact with you to work with you if they wanted to?
My website is eudemedics.com. If you feel, you know, there's the deeper mental health needs, then I can be found, and teams can be found at NHS Practitioner Health. And I guess the advantage there is that, you know, one will maybe a GP or a psychiatrist who will be part of the team to manage the kind of the whole kind of package of healthcare. And if you want sort of something in the middle, that's somewhere sort of between a bit of coaching and sort of lighter mental health needs, then you can find me at eudemedics.com.
If someone would like to work with you privately, your own website is eudemedics.com.
Yep.
And if they'd like to, they can find a whole team of people willing to help support them with their mental health at NHS Practitioner Health. We're often signposting people there for amazing confidential mental health support if you can't get that confidentially locally. So do check that out if you are struggling. And Nick, that just leaves me to say a huge thank you for coming on today and for sharing your amazing work with us. And please just take my thanks and the grateful thanks of all those I know you've worked with over the years and helped with you today. And it'd be lovely to have you back on the podcast again sometime.
Thank you, Caroline. And thank you for creating the space of the Joyful Doctor, that wonderful, open, sort of vulnerable space.
Thanks, Nick. Bye
for now. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Joyful Doctor podcast. To find out how the Joyful Doctor can help you or any caring professionals you know, please visit joyfuldoctor.com. Or check out my book, Permission, How to Feel, Heal and Thrive in a Challenging World, available via our website or Amazon now.